on today's Compassion Radio.
A lot of people in the United States do not know that there are even Christians in Iraq.
Even today, they don't know that.
Yeah. And so there have been, I think, over 100, 125 churches in Iraq that have been firebombed or torched or destroyed by explosives.
Intrepid.
When God tells you to go, then everything works out. He provides.
Involved.
It is so exciting to see what God can do, and this is why there is so much hope.
International.
Compassion Radio allows the listener to get involved in projects that are going to change history.
This is Compassion Radio.
Tracking the triumph of God in every nation on earth. Welcome to another edition of Compassion Radio, as we come to you on this, the first day of summer. Just right off the top, I wanted to share with you that our response this month for our Legacy of Learning Library project to honor our longtime host and president, Dr. Norm Nelson, could use a nice strong push as we look at the last 10 days of June. It would be such a blessing to hear from you today. Our number is 1-800-868-2478. Or reach out to us on our user-friendly website, CompassionRadio.com. Thanks so much. You know, with so many things going on in our world today, especially in the Middle East, it's imperative to have someone with a wealth of knowledge join us on the broadcast. And today's special guest has been a longtime friend and partner of this intrepid ministry. Here's Bram Floria to make introductions.
It's been a while since I've had Jim Jennings sit down with me and talk about the state of the church around the world, but we have him back today to talk about the most recent news from the Middle East. Jim, welcome back to Compassion Radio.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here, Bram, with you.
Now, we had a lot of talk in the past month, just personally over the table, about what's going on in the Middle East, and of course, it's now hit the news. We have nations acting as if they're spoiled brats with each other, and these are supposed to be people who are allies in business and in politics, but yet, in the Middle East right now, a number of OPEC countries are cutting off one of their brothers, and that country is Qatar. So I want to talk with you, Jim, about what the repercussions are from that particular development in bad diplomacy and what the ramifications might be for things that we care about, people of faith around the world. So can you tell me just a little bit, Jim, about what's going on right now politically and socially in the Middle East and around the Persian Gulf?
Well, first of all, Qatar is a small peninsula extending from the eastern side of the Arabian Peninsula and into the Persian Gulf, but it's fabulously wealthy in terms of oil and natural gas. It's sitting on a huge bubble of natural resources that have made it very rich. So you want to talk about fabulous wealth. It's a resident in the nation of Qatar, whose capital is Doha. It's near to the United Arab Emirates there and just south of Kuwait and Bahrain, the island in the north of the Persian Gulf. It's ruled by a traditional Arab sheikh. It has a population of workers that have come in to work in a fabulous city that's been built. 88% of the people are not natives to that area and belong there. So imagine they're ruled by 10 or 12% of the native people. What's interesting about it, I think, from our point of view, is that there are about 14% of the people in the country that are Christians.
Yep.
And so you have a country right in the middle of the most strict Sunni and Shiite parts of the Middle East that has a much larger than normal Christian population.
Now, that Christian population certainly is outsized for the region, because we talk about the Christian church in general, and any one of those countries might be approaching, if we're lucky, maybe 1%. So when you import a workforce for a country that's in the millions, and 10% of those are Christians, the opportunities for Christian witness in front of their Arab hosts is quite large. Now, I understand that Qatar is a fairly tolerant society for religious and cultural things because they don't have much choice. If they're going to hire them, they have to accommodate their life and their lifestyles.
Exactly, yes.
Perhaps the countries around there resent that a bit, but it's more than just an issue of them being wealthy and hiring help from around the world. There's other stuff going on about their relationship with their immediate neighbors. Now, you mentioned Doha being a fabulously wealthy city. It's the home of Qatar Airlines, and it's kind of in a lively rivalry with Dubai just across the peninsula from them as being one of the world hubs for air traffic and for commerce in competition with their architecture. So these rival kingdoms along the Arabian Peninsula are really interesting to contrast and compare with each other. But what do you think is at the root of this particular conflict? Now, I understand that the other Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia, has been complaining that Qatar is a sponsor of terrorism, which seems a bit ironic in that most of the terrorists that have attacked us directly have come from Saudi Arabia, one of our stated allies. So what do you think is really going on between those states and Qatar right now?
Well, it's a complex mix of motivations, and it's absolutely fascinating because there are issues that are political, religious, and economic involved in it. I should explain what happened is that the Sunni countries, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, have cut off their diplomatic relations with Qatar, which you would think is one of their closest allies and friends. But as you pointed out, it's a pluralistic society. The cities of Doha and Dubai in the United Arab Emirates are like Las Vegas in the desert, or like Arabian Nights fairyland. They are the most fantastic metropolises that you will find in anywhere in the world, except maybe in Hong Kong. And so there is a lot of competition and jealousy about it. But essentially, it's an aspect of the centuries-old Sunni-Shia divide. It reflects also the destabilizing effects of the Arab Spring, which causes the normal traditional rulers to totter on their thrones. Mm-hmm. And the Sunni governments in the region are really tired of Qatar's television network, which is the worldwide and very famous Al Jazeera network.
Now, isn't that interesting? Let me stop you there for 1 second, Jim, to talk about Al Jazeera real quickly. Our impression during the early years of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was that Al Jazeera spoke for the entire Arab world. And of course, that's really not true, but it's the only news outlet that we were aware of in the West. Why is Al Jazeera so provocative to the Sunnis, especially in the Middle East?
Well, they supported in several places, not everywhere, but they supported the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, that regime that was overthrown by al-Sisi, the general. That is the one aspect of the Arab Spring. But that's not all. They told the truth. They put the spotlight on the Arab dictators and the Arab rulers. Of course, they hated that. For them to support the Morsi government in Egypt, which was elected and backed by the Muslim Brotherhood, that was too much. And so Egypt and Saudi Arabia both are accusing Qatar of supporting terrorism, but that's also has nuances. It's complicated about Syria war and the fact that the U.S. was involved in smuggling arms into Syria and backing it. So was Saudi Arabia, so was Qatar. All of that ended up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, which is an ally of al-Qaeda. So they pulled out that card to play when the time was right. But actually, Saudi Arabia and others, UAE, had been supporting those kind of people all along as well, the Muslim Brotherhood and some even to the al-Nusra Front. So in a way, it's all about coming to this issue, Iran. It's about the opposition of the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia and other Sunni countries to Iran. And the West and Israel have joined in with that because they like that idea. It's a tipping point, it seems to me, in the struggle, which I mentioned, the Sunni-Shia divide.
Now, the Sunni-Shia divide, we talk about that a lot now in the West. We're finally aware of the fact that Islam itself was divided quite literally down the middle at the very early years of the religion. Soon after Muhammad himself was no longer on the scene, there was competition that broke into some very severe and warring factions that are still warring today. And most of the oil, of course, is in Sunni territories, but there's a huge amount of it that's also run by the Shia. And the Shia has an 800-pound gorilla called Iran, but it's not the only Shia country in the world. When we think about all the nations of the Middle East, we think in terms of a binary in the West. We have Democrats and Republicans in our politics, two largest parties that will ever rule in our system. So we think about one or the other. Now, the Middle East, all these factions, all these countries are kind of like the different chess pieces and different parties of a parliament, in that alliances can shift and minority governments can rule if they get enough partners on their side for a certain period of time. So you have alliances of convenience for whatever your particular national goals are. And that seems to be what's happening with a whole box of chess pieces getting shaken up quite vigorously right now in the Middle East. on purpose. This is not accidental that people are suddenly breaking up ties with other nations. And you say that it's about Iran, and it's not just about the Shia issues. At the same time that the Middle East is creating a manufactured crisis with Qatar, it is in fact driving Qatar much closer to Iran. And Iran is already shipping a huge amount of relief supplies, and airplanes are landing left and right to bring food and medicines and things into Qatar during the standoff with these other Arab brothers. What's going to be the effect, do you think, of that push into the arms of Iran?
It could be, Bram, a tipping point for the next great conflagration in the Middle East. I do not see how it can be avoided, in part because money is involved in a big way. The Qataris have $300 billion on hand for their military alone, and there's a new natural gas field. You talk about their alliance with Iran under the waters of the Persian Gulf. The natural gas field is shared with Iran. They both own it. And other countries in the region really want to make sure that Qatar and its major TV influence with Al Jazeera and its money and its friendship with Iran are not the determining factors in the future of the region. And so when you look at that, you have to go back and say that the present crisis did not happen in a vacuum. Starting with 1979 and the Iranian Revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini. Many other things followed that. The Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988, the first Gulf War the U.S. was involved in 1991, the sanctions the U.S. had on Iraq for 15 years, the American occupation following that, the Iraq War 2003 to 2011, the Arab Spring, Syrian Civil War, Bahrain protests, which really triggered this sort of tripwire about the Shia in Bahrain, who were similar to the number in Qatar. That made everybody nervous. The war in Yemen, then, we haven't mentioned, started in 2015, shortly after King Salman became ruler in Saudi Arabia. And that also is a proxy war, as the war in Syria is, and as this conflict crisis, we could say, with Qatar is. So it's complicated, but you can simplify it by saying that there's a coalition of Western nations, United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, against Iran, and they're using Qatar as a proving ground for that. It doesn't look, unless it can be solved diplomatically, to avoid an expansion of generalized conflict in the region.
Which, of course, could be vastly disruptive towards our way of life, in that so much is still tied up to the international price of oil, and whether or not we have the capacity to support ourselves and live off our own land, which we can do. We're still tied to the markets that involve all of these other fields around the world and China's demand for natural gas and for oil. Obviously, we're going to feel it at the pump. We're going to feel it in the pocketbook if something blows up again in the Middle East, especially with a country which up to this point have been somewhat stable.
Such an important discussion on today's Compassion Radio. And we'll get right back to Bram's conversation with Jim Jennings in just a moment. Now, here's a special word from Cher Nelson along with Bram.
He wanted his library to be divided up and to go to overseas libraries in seminaries and Christian colleges where books are just, you know, like gold. The resources that they have are so limited, and he wanted so much to get good information, good teaching materials into the hands of young pastors all over the world. And of course, as we traveled, we ran into them all over the place. He preached at almost every seminary that we discovered around the world, and always wanted a tour through their library to see what they had, and came back in tears many times just because they don't have things to study. So we're hoping that we can really bless the church universal with his library.
Now, I know everything's going digital these days, but when it comes to seminary libraries, they especially like to hit the written word on the page and to absorb it as if the author was speaking to them directly. Now, this is even more important for countries where they have very few mentors. We need to do that for pastors, and that's what this project is about. We're going to be taking the books, the prime books especially, of Norm's collection, and identifying which of the places in the world that we work with before that have seminary libraries that need those works to help train and deepen the knowledge of the pastors that are being trained there. The process of getting them ready for shipment and figuring out which titles will go to where. So that's our work this month, is getting ready to forward Norm's legacy to ready hands and get this generation, this year, people actually using these books in ministry and training those who are going out to be evangelists in those parts of the world.
For me, keeps his work alive, keeps his passion alive. I can't wait to see what these young pastors glean from these books and what effect it has on their ministry.
If you'd like to help with this month's Legacy of Learning Library Project, reach out to us by calling 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. By mail at Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. That's Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Or find us online at CompassionRadio.com. Let's get back now to the program.
Obviously, we're going to feel it at the pump. We're going to feel it in the pocketbook if something blows up again in the Middle East, especially with a country which, up to this point, have been somewhat stable. Now, Americans seem to be understanding or believing that we have a stable conflict between Shia and Sunni in the Middle East. It's not a stable conflict, of course, and as you've mentioned, it's a set of shifting alliances that are tribal as much as they are religious. And if the calculus changes greatly and other countries are driven together in new coalitions, it could be greatly destabilizing in our own foreign policy, not knowing who the actors are, who the strong players are anymore, which puts American interests at risk. Let me jump now to the other important things for you. Now, Jim, you spent many, many years traveling throughout the Middle East. You still do. You speak the language, at least the Arabic language, very well. And so you're able to hear the nuance of what's going on in conversations all around that region. What are the ramifications for believers in the countries where these conflicts might take place, or in these countries that are getting more and more antagonistic toward each other? Where are the danger points for believers throughout the Middle East?
Well, in short, has been devastating to the churches in the Middle East who've been there for centuries. They have been a minority since the 7th century, but at least they were able to hold their head up and to keep living in those cities, from Shiraz in Iran, where the Armenian church has been for many centuries, to the Coptic church in Egypt, to the many Protestants in Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, as well as the Orthodox churches. This has been a devastating period of time. You can talk about the persecution of the church and see that in Egypt recently there were two attacks on Coptic churches in which many people were killed, and then just most recently a bus was attacked, a church bus where people were going on a visit to a monastery. I believe 26 people were killed by a group that claimed it was allied with the Islamic State in North Syria, North Iraq. And this is just one country, Egypt. If you go to North Iraq, as I did recently, and met with the people from the churches who had fled from the plain of Nineveh, you know, Nineveh in the Old Testament is a northern part of what is the city of Mosul now, where the fighting has been going on for many months, and some 400,000 civilians have fled. Over the last year, since 2014, the plain of Nineveh, which is a beautiful, fertile plain stretching eastward from Nineveh, there were many, many Christian villages and churches. A lot of people in the United States do not know that there are even Christians in Iraq.
Even today, they don't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there have been, I think, over 125 churches in Iraq that have been firebombed or torched or destroyed by explosives. And in the plain of Nineveh, that's where the classic Christian heartland of Iraq was for many years. Many of those villages have been destroyed, and I went through many of them. They're devastated. And there are monasteries, there are churches in which ISIS fighters blew up. They just put dynamite and exploded those churches and monasteries. I was in two of those monasteries before the war, and now they are in ruins. So the people who have fled have mostly fled to the Kurdish zone, which is safer, and many of them are still all around northern Iraq in Kurdish zone, in many, many refugee camps. I think that if we knew our history and if we knew about the church in the Middle East, we would be alarmed, and we, as Christians in the West, would do something to help those people. And yet, for the most part, Christians have ignored or neglected those crying out for help from us because their situation is desperate.
Now, Jim, you and Norm have been the sentinels, the lighthouse for us for 20 years or more on the radio about these Christian communities. And we are grateful to you for that and for your passion for the believers in these hidden places. And again, we don't talk about them being hidden because they're not visible. They're hidden because we don't pay attention. And perhaps because we're evangelicals, we have such a fixation on the success of Israel that we forget about our body of Christ all around that part of the world, which predated the creation of modern Israel by, you know, thousands of years. So we really do have a history in the Middle East as a body, as a family, as a body of Christ that goes back all the way to the apostle times. And that's why the Assyrian church being lost in northern Iraq is such a tragedy for us, because they're the last remaining believers in Christianity, which still speak and worship in the languages that the apostles spoke. And there's very few of them left. It's like God's allowing an entire epoch to die and allowing men to do it. So I grieve for this, because it seems like we've lost our roots as a body. How are we going to recapture our zeal for the continuity of the gospel from the time that it left Palestine in the first century to the way it trickled all the way down to us in the West thousands of years later? How are we going to reclaim our heritage, Jim?
Well, first of all, Norman Nelson was a shining light and a dear friend of mine who had a passion for doing exactly this very thing, that is to bring information to Christians in the West, to inform them about the situation throughout the region, but in particular of the suffering church and the persecuted church, which he did beautifully. I think we simply need to keep calling attention to the fact that these are our brothers and sisters, and they're suffering. When you mentioned, Bram, the whole concept of relating to those people, that we shouldn't cut ourselves off from our roots, I thought that was remarkable, because if you cut yourself off from your roots as a family, as a nation, as a people, as a faith, you lose your identity. And it's not just about the suffering people in the Middle East today, Bram. Honestly, it's about our Christian identity. Who are we? I had a colleague when I taught at Wheaton College. His name was Robert Weber. He's now deceased. But Bob wrote the book on Christian roots. He rediscovered, as a professor of theology, the fact that we were connected with our ancient roots, with the ancient church, with the church of St. Augustine and St. Ambrose and St. Athanasius and all the great people throughout history, especially in the region of the Middle East, in Antioch and Alexandria, Jerusalem. In all those areas, that church is still there. It is still faithful. It is still witnessing with the community, and they have suffered incredibly in the last number of decades that I've been traveling and working in the Middle East. I wish that we would, instead of trying to enforce our Western way of doing things on those people, if we would come and walk alongside them, help them in their suffering and misery, to share our testimony of witness, I think it would be a healing thing, not just for the people who are now living in tents, living among the ruins, suffering from wounds, suffering the terrible scourge of the so-called Islamic State, ISIS. It would help not only those people, it would help us in the West, who are like the Church of Laodicea that is often too lukewarm.
And that wraps up part one of a timely discussion between Bram Floria and our very special guest and longtime friend to Norman Cher Nelson and this entire ministry, and that's Jim Jennings. Be sure to check back in with us again tomorrow for part two of this discussion right here on Compassion Radio. Friend, the best of Norm's theological library will be donated to these crucially important institutions as a living legacy. Just think of it. Words that have moved Norm and shaped this ministry and thousands of partners over the years will now shape the ministry of future generations of pastors. Could there be a better legacy to leave behind? This month, we're asking you to help us send the next generation of pastors and evangelists in the world's toughest places exactly what they need: quality commentaries and study materials. It will begin with Norm's personal collection. Each book will include a dedication placard commemorating Norm, his life, and your gift as a Compassion Radio partner. Your gift of any size this month is needed and important. Please give as generously as you can to keep this ministry on the air as your radio voice for global mission and to equip desperately needed theological seminaries with the books they need to effectively train pastors. For your gift of $25 or more this month to our Legacy of Learning Library project, we'd love to send you a thank you gift. We are working on several different projects, either about or by Norm Nelson, and we're trying to make it a memorable and meaningful representation of his ministry. As you probably all know personally, deaths in the family throw everyone off kilter for a bit. Thank you, friends, for your cards and your letters and calls to share, Bram, and the Compassion Radio team. Please call our office at 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address, by the way, Compassion Radio, Post Office Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. That's Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Online, we're at CompassionRadio.com. And that phone number once more, 1-800-868-2478. On behalf of Bram Floria, Cher Nelson, and the entire Compassion Radio team, have a wonderful day in the Lord. And we'll see you again next time with more Compassion Radio.